It is Saturday, November 15th, 2014. We are broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio 88.9 and KUSP.org. And ladies and gentlemen, it's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP or any of the geeks' affiliated organizations. Yeah, welcome, welcome. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch in the host chair today, and with me in the studio is Miles Elam, a software engineer and political junkie.
Good morning.
There he is. He's there. Okay, that means we officially have a show today. And today on the show, we're going to be talking about a lot of sort of ethical questions in technology. I sense a strain in the topics that we've been discussing before the show. I want to start. Is it okay if I start with the Radiotopia thing? There's been some wonderful success in independent creatives who do in radio, independent producers banding together and creating their own sort of network called Radiotopia. Now, we've seen these before. Jesse Thorne, formerly of KUSP, did The Sound of Young America at KZSE. And then KUSP came under KUSP's ping for a while, and then he started up his own thing in L.A. Now he's got several shows in a network of podcasts called Maximum Fun.
So what's the type of thing that these people can do now that they're getting funding through Kickstarter?
Well, all kinds of stuff. They start off with a fairly humble goal, and then people just kept exceeding their goals, and they still had time left on the Kickstarter, so they kept coming up with these stretch goals. Now they've added more people into their network than there were before. They have a gender parity among the hosts of the podcasts. They're actually able now to start a development fund to scout around for people who want to either contribute to existing podcasts or start one up of their own. And it's kind of exciting. It's kind of exciting in one sense, in that people, this is another example of the internet making it possible for people to reach an audience directly and not rely on, some sort of intermediary. So in that sense, it's fantastic. And here we are at a radio station.
Right. But you were talking about podcasts.
I was talking about
podcasts. This is called Radiotopia. So how does that fit together?
Well, I think all of these people come from radio in some fashion. The stars, of course, of the group are the Kitchen Sisters, who also came from KUSP, who are offering everything they've made, I think, as one of the things that you can reach through Radiotopia. But you also have Ben Walker and Roman Mars up at KALW in San Francisco. You have Lee Tao, who's working as an independent producer with the Independent Producing Project for KCRW, another fantastic station out of Santa Monica. So these are all people who have some sort of radio backing, or blessings from Ira Glass, who's he just sort of makes everything good in public radio possible, it seems like, just by putting his attention on it. So it's good for them, and they're not totally independent in that, you're right, they do have a radio backer. So now the question is, can people who are really starting just from their own garage, from their own bedroom, without some sort of radio affiliation, get in on this creative action? And I'd like to think that because Radiotopia now has the possibility of like this a development arm, that can happen. It's also technically possible because of something called the Public Radio Exchange, PRX, which is the network that This American Life is now on. They left their affiliation with a traditional broadcast distributor and went with PRX, which is, you know, hangs its hat on being a friend to the independent producer.
Yeah, ostensibly I'm part of this industry, you know, at least once a week I'm part of this industry. Once a week for 15 years, so I guess it counts.
That adds up. But
I had no idea.
Oh, it's all going on. It's all going on. We'll provide links at geekspeak.org so you can check out what Radiotopia is about. I should put up MaximumFun.org also if you're not aware of that network of podcasts. That's a fantastic one. And, you know, their Kickstarter campaign, and we can all sort of explore together. Well, how do they do that? How can I do that?
Yeah, you know? I think I'll be checking that out on after the show.
Yeah, but it also tells me that creativity in audio is alive and well and is not going to go away as, you know, people are looking to the web and more on-demand listening as opposed to tuning into whatever delightful randomness is crossing your ears on the FM band.
Yeah. With videos, it's like that's your attention.
Yeah.
And radio, I can listen to a discussion, but if something else takes my attention, I can shift off and do that.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, I can just like listen in and be thinking about the issues and stuff like that. And
right.
Yeah, it's
nice to know that there's a lot of room for audio. There's a podcast that's really taken the listening world by storm called Serial. It's an outcropping of This American Life, and it's Sarah Koenig, one of their longtime producers, following a particular story over time. You have to tune in next Thursday. You know, that's when the next one's going to be posted, and you can see the next installment of her. And in this first round, she's solving kind of a crime mystery. Mm-hmm. And it's not clear that it's always going to be solving a crime mystery, but that's a perfect one to start with. And people are obsessed enough that I think I just saw the first, there's a satire site called Funny or Die, and they post videos there. And it's a way for comedians to kind of reach an audience directly without having to have an HBO hour-long special or something. So they produce these little videos and they're funny. And it was the very first time I saw something on Funny or Die that was just strictly audio. And it was a mashup between Wrecking Ball, Miley Cyrus's, and the Serial theme song. So things are happening out there for audio, and it bodes well for you and me, Miles. That's going to be my stand. It bodes well for us.
Awesome.
Yes. Also on that note, by the way, if I can just keep going on and on, Miles.
Hey.
There's a fellow named Ben Walker, who does a podcast called The Theory of Everything. It's one of the Radiotopia podcasts. And he's going to start a mini-series within that podcast called The Dislike Club, which might be very interesting, especially for you and I. It's people who are sort of
because
experts.
Because we dislike so many things? Like what?
Yeah. But it's, you know, folks who never joined Facebook debating with people who really are aware of what's going on in the internet landscape, talking about where should the internet go from here.
Okay.
You know, when it's becoming more commercialized and you're starting to see, corporations want to have some control over how we can access the internet, what do we do from here?
Right. Which is funny because one of the stories that had come up that I'm not going to go into much detail was Facebook wanting to ratchet back some of their promotional ads.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Are you serious?
Just
Why?
Because they're getting some negative effect. People are getting bombarded so much. It's diluting the
So
the
that's
product.
Not just me? It is annoying.
They're still going to have ads. I mean,
right.
Don't get me wrong. They're just going to try to tweak them so they're not quite as
in your face
and all the time.
Yeah. Well, that's good. So do you think that if enough people speak up, we can influence what corporations do with our internet experience?
Depends, because I mean, there's a whole lot of research that says that if you're in the 1%, you're going to get representation from Congress, and if not, you're not, or from your local municipality, because that's really where the freedom comes into play. Because if you don't want to use Facebook, I mean, there's a social cost because someone might want to put up events on Facebook or put up pictures, but you can choose to opt out of that. With regard to the last mile for internet connection. More and more of us are tied to, we have our choice of Comcast, Verizon, AT&T. And
when you refer to the last mile of interconnection, you mean it's like going from the general grid to an individual's.
Right. So if I'm going accessing a website that's in Tokyo or that's hosted by someone who's in Tokyo.
Right. There we go.
Then that's going to be going through all of these chains, and I don't know anything about it, and it just deals with peers that know a lot about the technology, and they're just doing their peering deals and figuring that out. But then you hit that last bit, because that point in between going from the East Coast to the West Coast of the U.S., for example, mm-hmm. is ridiculously fast. Mm-hmm. The backbone can handle a huge amount. But what happens is you get to these edge points, and suddenly, until recently, we were maxing out at like 6 megabits, mm-hmm. something like that, mm-hmm. and with like DSL. And cable has pushed us a bit further, but we're still paying a fair amount. But at the same time, there's this arguments about net neutrality that drop in.
Yeah. And so the argument there is, if people want faster speeds, they ought to be able to pay for them. And the counter argument is, well, wait a minute. Why should I? Why should money be the determining factor about whether you deserve a faster connection or not? No?
I don't know that I would categorize it that way. The faster connection, like if you get a 15 megabit versus a 50 megabit connection, I can see the argument for you pay more mm-hmm. for it. I think we shouldn't pay as much for that, but that's a whole other argument. But what we have is a setup where I have paid for, say, 50 megabit connection, mm-hmm. and then I want Netflix. But then they're saying, but we want Netflix, because it's going through Cogent and Level 3, we want them to pay us more to get onto our network because we have to, because they're using more bandwidth.
So it's not about how fast I get stuff, it's about what I have access to at all. If a company cannot pay to match the speed of a heavy hitter like Netflix.
Right. Netflix actually has some deep pockets now, so yeah. they can pay for it. But if you have someone who has a similarly good idea mm-hmm. and go like, oh, well, you're going to have to pay. Or
let's say a band of, you know, independently produced film or radio or audio stuff. Mm-hmm. Like if they wanted to have give people as quick access to their content as Netflix, they'd have to pony up. Yeah.
Or more specifically, if you have a player like Comcast that is a cable provider and they want to get into the business of, or they are already in the business of shelling out movies, mm-hmm. but also want to produce their own content, mm-hmm. suddenly they can say, oh, well, we have our own setup, so we want HBO Go to go slower, or we want Netflix to go slower, or we want Hulu to go slower.
Oh, okay. We're going to care about our own stuff content looks creation better. And care less about people providing it that
we're... Right. And that's really the core of what the net neutrality okay. argument is about, is can established players use their oligopoly control of mm-hmm. that last mile mm-hmm. to control content, to be able to okay. push out any new players.
Yeah. So the last mile is something that people are looking at very closely and wanting to be able to control.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the fact that in municipalities, like you, if I don't like Comcast and I want a different cable provider, mm-hmm. I don't have an
option.
It's
too bad. Yeah.
Yeah. The municipality, they have a regional monopoly.
Mm-hmm.
If I want something, if I want DSL, I have my choice of AT&T or... Mm-hmm. Or the companies that contract through AT&T.
Right. Which are several.
But they end up being better, because then you can still end up with, at least with their contracting through AT&T through those pipes, you have that choice. With the cable provider, it's, that's the end of it.
Yeah. And so we're talking about the last mile and wanting connection there to be good, and that being a question about how you... I forget how we got onto the whole question of the last mile.
And this is something that that Obama was bringing up recently that came up in the news.
Oh, so he made a statement like, come on, guys, let's get it together. Of course, he doesn't have any influence over the FCC.
I don't know that he put it in quite those terms. But
I'm pretty sure word for word that's what he said.
but yeah, he was pushing for the FCC to reclassify these internet companies that mm-hmm. provide what we call the last mile. Mm-hmm. to be under Title II, which is a telecommunications company. And internet,
a company?
Internet or a telecommunications umbrella. Now, they're an information... internet is classified as an information backbone, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. telecommunications is slightly different. That is data at a distance.
The last time we tried to address net neutrality, it kind of fell apart on that technical issue.
Right, and that's where things are... Or arguing. In fact, after Obama said that, you had a whole lot of well, Republicans up on the Hill saying you can't tell the SEC to treat broadband as a utility. The FCC doesn't have that authority, even though a Superior Court
specifically have that.
They said, like, no, FCC, you can't regulate telecoms in this way unless you were to treat them as Title II.
You gave them the pathway.
And so that has been going back and forth. AT&T has then said, well, if you're going to classify us as Title II, then with this net neutrality thing, then we're going to put our gigabit internet fiber plans on hold. In other words, so it was like this whole threat. If you make us deal with this, we're going to take our ball and go home.
Which is exactly the thing that everyone's afraid of with, if there is no net neutrality, then that's exactly the kind of dynamic we can expect.
Or rather,
if
there is no competition in this.
Right. I'm going to take my toys and make it harder for you.
Right. The FCC, however, has, to their credit, not backed down after a couple of days after AT&T said they were going to have to, quote, pause their rollout, their 100-city fiber rollout.
Oh, that's right. They were going to do the fiber optic deal.
The FCC was like, oh, really? Exactly which 100 cities were you actually going to be doing it rather than evaluating? What was the timetable and what is your...
Tell us more.
Yeah, what exactly were you going to be doing here? Because right now it sounds like a whole bunch of smoke and mirrors to get us to not do what we're planning on doing. Just to give some background on this. Back in the 90s, for those of us who remember the late 90s and the internet boom...
Yeah.
A whole bunch of money when DSL was first coming out was coming into laying down fiber and putting in high speed connections. So if you had a phone bill or a DSL bill, but even a phone bill, you had an extra levy put onto your bill to add onto infrastructure to have this high speed internet. And then after the 90s, a lot of us noticed, wait. Where's the high-speed internet?
Yeah.
This is the same speed when you talk about a factor of two, like it's twice as fast as we had before.
Right.
As opposed to other countries have gigabit speeds.
Well, that's what I was thinking, is that if you go to Europe or Asia, they're just
three orders of magnitude
higher.
Right.
They
just said, like, oh, well, we tried these things and sometimes it doesn't work out. Well, what about our money that you said that you were going to do this with the money?
Yeah, you took
that money. Well, hey, it just didn't work out. So now when I see things like this going, like, hey, we were going to lay out fiber, but now you're talking about net neutrality. So
yeah,
I don't know if we can. I do wonder if the credibility is shot in terms of, okay, then we won't push forward these net neutrality things. Wait, where's my fiber? Is it going to wait again until Google Fiber comes into play, and then suddenly AT&T goes, "Hey, we were going to do fiber in that exact municipality as well, and lower our prices."
Let me see if I've got this straight, Miles. Before this, you thought that they did have some credibility.
Honestly, back when in the 90s, when they were talking about we're going to take this extra money and we're going to put it toward this goal of making very high speed internet available in a lot of different places. Yeah, I believed it. The 20 something naive.
Golly.
The internet's going to change everything,
Well, I'll tell you about
ingenue was just going, "What?"
Golly. It's Geek Speak here on KUSP. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch in the studio with Miles Elam. We're talking about leaving this big, beautiful thing we have up to individual fallible minds. Well, that may not be a good idea.
Nice.
I'm not sure what the alternative is, though. But before we came on the air, you mentioned that,
many of us have a very warm feeling in our heart for the Atari 2600.
Okay, so we're talking about nostalgia for technology of the past.
For many of us of a certain age, we remember, the Pac-Man, the tank, the Warlords, the Pong.
Yeah, don't forget Pong.
Pong with the paddles, yeah.
Yeah.
And those were the ones we really liked. There were other ones, of course, like Asteroids. I could go on forever.
Yeah,
on
many games. Yeah.
Ones that, this was a heyday, a golden age of games that a lot of us look back to and say, like, yeah, they were very simple. They didn't have 3D effects, but they were engaging. They were fun.
They got us.
And then there are the ones that we like to forget because they were not so fun and not so engaging.
Well, there was one that people had a lot of hope for, and then it was just terrible.
Yes, that would be E.T. the Extraterrestrial.
Yes.
Now, the movie came out. Yeah. It was great. It was like, if you make this game halfway decent, people will buy it and play it, and it'll be okay.
Well, it seemed like marketing gold. Reese's Pieces took off, you know.
Right. And this game was a stinker. Not only was it hard, but when you did get E.T. back into a ship, it was like, really? That's it?
Now what?
I get to do it again?
Okay. Yeah.
Only harder?
So it just didn't seem like there was a lot of goal or excitement or reward.
Right. Involved. It was like, how do I get E.T. out of the crater? What?
Yeah. What am I, a golf game here? So now, notoriously, a bunch of those cartridges were dumped somewhere in the desert.
I was thinking, you know, thankfully, they had a huge glut of these cartridges that no one wanted to buy.
Yeah.
No one wanted them. It's 1983. Yeah. And people are buying 2,600 cartridges right and left, and yet
they
can't even give these away.
Yeah.
And so as a loss, because they can't just have them in a warehouse because someone could grab them, someone could use them. So you have to dispose of them.
Right. Now, we covered this before on Geek Speak. I'm trying to remember which episode it was, but it was discovered, right? A whole cache of these was discovered
because they
had been buried.
Right. They didn't say where they buried them. So somewhere in the New Mexico desert, they dumped all of these cartridges. They crushed them first, and then they buried them, and good riddance.
Yeah.
And they found them, which is, from my point of view, like a good archaeological find.
Right.
It's kind of like, hey, here's this thing that happened. Well, now, someone has decided to sell them.
Now, you have a problem with this, which I don't have. Someone has found these and come up with a good business idea.
Right. The city of Alamogordo, thank you.
In New Mexico.
Raised $36,000 or over that by auctioning off 100 cartridges. In other words, that each one went for up to, you know, $1,500.
Yeah.
Now, a piece of internet history, I guess so, in the same way that, like, I guess someone could sell the proceeds from a Superfund site.
Yeah. it seems weird to you. And what seems weird is that people were willing to spend $1,500 on this clunker of junk. It's junk. It's not like you could even necessarily play them, could you?
No, they were crushed. They were totally destroyed.
So there's these mangled games that were bad from the start, and why are people willing to pay
$1,500? And I don't know that someone who was selling one that they did play, so a used copy, if they could get $1,500 for.
I thought when you first told me this story that it was just one enterprising business person who went, hey, I'm going to make some cash. But now it turns out it's Alamogordo, New Mexico. As we know, cities are hurting for funding all across this fine land, and it seems fine to raise money for something that people are willing to pay for. It's also true, I'm just going to... It's also the case that people are often willing to spend more to get a thing than the thing is worth. We see that in public radio all the time. Back when we were offering mugs, you know, with your membership, it's not about the mug, right? But it is about, you know, throwing money at potentially a worthy cause.
Yeah. I guess I just have this weird thought of, if you had $1,500 to spend on a cartridge, a broken cartridge of an atrociously bad game.
Yeah. Really not worth any part of the value that you're paying for it.
In the top five worst games ever created.
A dollar might be too much to spend on this thing.
You would think maybe, I don't know, you could say, hey, I'm okay with raising my taxes by a couple of pennies.
Maybe I've got some more willingness there, or maybe I want to feed some people directly.
Right, or I want to pay someone's rent in a low-income area for 3 months.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
As opposed to, hey, I have this broken piece of plastic in fairness, the broken piece of plastic is just as useful as the broken piece of plastic of the finest video games ever created.
The materials themselves.
Right. Yeah. So, but yeah.
You've got a quandary there. I see that you've got a quandary.
Yes.
Yeah. because if you were
good on
to spend
Alamogordo.
I mean, it's very innovative, very creative. I know a guy who's auctioning off his cancer port to help finish paying for his medical expenses. Now, who wants a cancer port? What are you going to do with that?
Who wants medical expenses? Yeah, that bankrupt us. Anyway,
that's a whole other issue. But you see what I'm saying? Like in this day and age, right? When frankly we're still feeling the effect, except for the 1%, we're still feeling the effects of the recession. You got to get creative with how you make your dollar. Even if you know you take advantage of the 1% to do it.
I wish it were. I don't know that the $1,500 is the 1%, but I don't
know. Who knows? Who knows? But really,
maybe it is the truth. Maybe it is you try to get all these things that appeal to the 1% and try to funnel them into good causes.
Really? I mean, remember when Bush gave us what was it $600 or $300 or something? It was
income tax credit.
Right. I thought
actually Reagan started that one.
Was it him? Okay. Yeah. So it happened in my lifetime. I got like a $600 check for something that I thought the government should be putting to better use. So I gave it to KUSP. I decided for the government what that money should have been spent on.
Right. And many people have that view of individuals in the large are going to be better at spending the money intelligently than a central authority.
But then when you get people willing to pay $1,500 for a cartridge, you start to lose hope. They're not going to make good decisions about what to do with their money.
Yeah, I was actually thinking people make great decisions about where they spend their money as long as they have money.
As long as they have money. That's a good point. Yeah. 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 Well, I basically, for me, like if we took out the whole sort of charity aspect out of this situation, it would still be okay with me if a seller was clear about what they were selling and what the price was and there was no shenanigans.
Oh, sure.
There.
There's no fraud involved. I'm not
and
trying to assert that.
And a buyer is fully aware of what they're paying for and making a free will decision about whether or not to spend that money. I don't have a problem.
Okay.
If it's their money, if they want to do that, that's fine. That's my take on it. But I get that people making goofball decisions about their money when there's plenty of real world kind of needs for it. It can be hard to witness and just let happen. But some people are doing a good job of being scrappy with limited resources. Philae landed on the comet and then it landed in a super shady spot.
Philae.
It's Philae. Well, we talked about this before too.
Yeah,
it's so
you
funny.
Put the pronunciation down. Yeah, Philae.
It's because every time I see Philae lander, I think Philander.
It's dallying with that comet.
Yeah, it's having a little woo. I was trying to make it sexy. Okay, so they landed in a spot that gives them what 1.5 hours of sunlight, and it's a solar powered thing. It really needs 6 to get going.
Well, they landed it in the correct spot. It just bounced.
Okay.
And because the comet is by comparison to a body, planetary body like the Earth. Mm-hmm. So small, the gravity is so much lower that it hit the ground and then it bounced and it was up for an hour and change.
Yeah.
Just kind of do. But there was enough gravity that it didn't get escape velocity.
Okay.
It came back down again, bounced again. 7 minutes later, it came to its final resting stop.
Oh, that's what that XKCD comic was about.
Right. And that's why it is in a bad spot. Because the original spot where it hit, that was where it was getting great sun.
Yeah.
And then it bounced and ended
strayed
up
a
in
bit.
The... in the comet version of Iceland.
Oh, gosh. Okay. So now what?
So,
they had like 60 hours of power by the time I heard that they just got it stuck in that
shady
spot.
Well, yeah, and that has dwindled quite a bit. Mm-hmm. Quite a bit. It's now at any
it's
moment.
It's been a day or two. Yeah.
Yeah. And but at the same time, it has given back all sorts of information, like what does the comet smell like?
Mm. What? We had a smellerator on that?
Yeah, hydrogen sulfide, methane, yeah.
Whoa.
All sorts of things that we find stinky and toxic.
Okay, got it. Okay. Oh, so by just knowing what the stuff is, we can imagine what it smells. It's not like there is a scent picker-upper.
Right. Well, I mean, that is what our scent picker-upper is.
Okay.
It analyzes the chemical composition of things and translates that into something that our brains can say, oh, well, that's a bad chemical. Let's convert that into something that we go, ooh, I don't want to be around that.
But we also have a sensory experience of that scent, which I'm guessing Philae does not have.
Well, I'm sure we could program in something like a picture of a nose on a screen, and then it detects something and goes,
you know, like, they are working on an artificial nose, but anyway.
But the lander wouldn't actually feel those feelings. It's just a simulacrum of them.
Yeah. So it's sending back useful information like the chemical composition of the comet and what that must smell like. It's communicating with Rosetta, right, who's orbiting the comet.
Mm-hmm. And Rosetta is still up and running and will be for some time.
Right.
So even if Philae has a problem where, for example, they run out of battery power, the batteries in general can become damaged if they remain discharged for too long.
Yeah.
And space is very, very cold. Uh-huh. Strangely enough, on top of a comet, it's not, you know, Tahiti. So that is another thing that can damage cells, damage electrical equipment in general.
Right.
For example, solder points can crack if they get too cold, that type
of
thing.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the things that a solar panel will provide, especially for the rovers that are on Mars, is they'll provide power for a heater so that the systems don't get too cold.
I don't know why I didn't think of that, but it's a fine use of it.
So they are hoping that when enough sunlight comes back to it as it trickle charges, as it were, that it will come back and be able to send some more data. But that's why it's uncertain.
Right.
We don't know what's going to happen when it's exposed to these conditions.
Now, they were able to jockey the position of Philae a little bit. Is that right? After he landed on his side?
Yeah. They were able to shift it, I think it was like 35 degrees, something like that, to be able to face the sun a little bit more.
A better angle given the spot that it's in.
Right.
Okay.
But it's still angling your solar panels in wintertime. You're never going to get that output of summer.
Yeah.
But at least you can try to angle them so you're more head-on with the
basil, maybe a cabbage. You're not going to be able to grow. Okay. That was my gardening.
And they also were able to do a drill. The drill bit went down in and came back up again. They were able to do that.
Okay, so you got the core. Okay, so that was a key part of the project.
Some good science came out of this. Like, it is not a failure by any stretch of the imagination. A lot of the data that they were trying to gather was relayed to Rosetta. Rosetta relayed it back to the Earth. So we got... So it was absolutely a success.
It's a lot of success.
Yes.
Did I tell you, years and years and years ago, my dad was an electrical engineer, participated in an experiment to create a microphone so you could actually hear what it sounded like on Mars. And so they launched off with a bunch of other experiments.
In the very thin atmosphere. Right?
Very thin. Yeah. Well, anyway, what happened was as soon as the craft landed, it just smashed into the surface of Mars and everything was destroyed. So less of a success. This is a much better success than the Mars
mission. As opposed to the rovers, which were the other end, where it's like, we're going to have these run for 90 days.
Yeah.
Many, many years later.
Yeah.
A decade later.
Still going. Yeah. Well, so more success in space exploration and so on. Now, this wasn't purely an American project, right? They're talking about ESA, the European Space Agency.
This was not an American project really very much at all. This was a European Space Agency.
And so I'm thinking back to Obama saying, we're going to land a craft on a comet.
Collective humanity.
Collective community is what he was talking about. Yes. We're going to participate in a collaborative thing because we can't do anything ourselves.
I mean, it was very hard to do. Like when we landed on the moon, we could say the U.S. landed on the moon, but also humanity landed on the moon.
Yeah,
and people kind of conflated the two.
Yeah.
And so now
we
need to make sure when we say we, it's the
really space the exploration
royal humanity
has been kind of my hope for international participation in cooperation. it's not happening on the ground. It does seem to be happening in space. Thank goodness. It's Geek Speak here on KUSP. You can find out more about this and any show at geekspeak.org. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch in the Air Studio today with Miles Elam, and we're talking about all the big juicy stuff. So there's a guy, Mr. Polygraph, I believe is his name. No, I don't know his name, but he did something he maybe ought not to have done.
Well, as it turns out, the polygraph expert is known as Doug Williams, but he is the owner of polygraph.com.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh, I see. He's not necessarily the inventor of the polygraph.
No, absolutely not.
Okay.
But he does make the statement, quote, I can teach you how to pass, nervous or not, no matter what. A polygraph.
Oh, I see. Okay, so because this is a service that he's providing at polygraph.com.
Right, because a polygraph deals with, you know, the amount of sweat, the acidity of your sweat, your pulse rate, things like stress markers.
Right.
And so this one was talking about, and by the way, he was a former Oklahoma City police officer.
Okay. probably a good cop.
So he's talking about how to beat the lie detector test. Yeah. And he has been indicted.
Indicted?
Yes.
Really?
The thing is, though, polygraphs have been under scrutiny for some time now.
Yeah, as to how, they've been unreliable because you can sweat for just being nervous, not because you're lying. Right?
Right. They are, as far as I'm aware, inadmissible as evidence in a case.
So people, then what's the problem?
Because people will take them merely as, you know, like, I did this as a show of good faith.
Pro forma,
and,
yeah.
Yeah, and that type of thing. But at the same time, you have a lot of these law enforcement officials who are very upset that he broke this tool down.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's the question there. A, was it ethical for him to do so?
Yeah.
Knowing that a polygraph is not sufficiently foolproof that it's admissible as evidence in a legal case.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a reason for that, because mm-hmm. it has a high false positive, false negative rate.
Okay.
A low enough reliability rate that we don't want to have that be a standard for putting someone in jail or keeping them out of it.
So part of the ethical quandary is, can you say that it's possible to game something that's that unreliable? Or
if something can be gamed like that and you tell people that it can be gamed, is that unethical?
Yeah. Or does it get into like a weird placebo territory? Like, we're curing you now and now you believe you're being cured, so you're being cured. You believe you can pass the test, so maybe you've got more confidence going into it.
Right. It's one of those things that we want to believe that a polygraph works. In much the same way that we want to believe that eyewitness testimony is the best way to work. And yet we know that eyewitness
super
testimony
reliable.
Is, yeah.
It's fraught.
It's horrible, yeah. Actually. There, you see experiments done in colleges mm-hmm. where a professor is up at the front, one that comes to mind,
mm-hmm.
and someone runs in, takes some item, mm-hmm. you know, from there and runs out again, or like, you know, bumps him, takes some stuff,
right.
runs out.
Yeah.
And the professor staying in character is like, what just happened? Does anybody remember what that person looked like?
Yeah.
Can you describe the person?
Yeah, there we go.
And so we have, you know, and everyone was right there and it just happened.
Yeah.
And people write down their answers and, you know, give it. And
big
people
variation.
Would get the gender of the person wrong.
Oh, my
they got,
gosh.
I'm not talking about, like, they
like
got the
basic stuff.
Yeah, not just the height. But, I mean, they got the gender. They would get the ethnicity wrong. Like, they, you know, white guy comes in, bumps him. And people were saying, like, looked Latino. He looked, looked black, or
like crazy assumptions going into what they see. Therefore, the eyeballs are not objective because they're connected to a subjective brain.
Right. And the polygraph is definitely in that area. Mm-hmm. In fact, probably even more so.
So would it be, I mean, was this the equivalent of like bringing into the station the guy who's offering pee-free pot or something, or pot-free pee? Or,
right. Yeah.
You know, I can help you pass your drug test. Is it that level of no-no for you?
See, that one, I don't know that I'm a good person to ask that, because I have big issues with drug testing in general for things that you're not operating heavy machinery.
Right.
But, yeah. I don't know. This one, I don't know, because the information...
I would like to think that most pot is pee-free.
Because that one, I mean... I guess with that one, it's along the lines of if you were doing the THC-free pee,
mm-hmm.
That is committing a fraud
mm-hmm.
because you are telling someone, this is my pee and it's not your pee.
Right.
This one, I don't see the same
it's a
fraud.
Little more gray
this
area.
One is more, it's very much a, hey, this is what a polygraph is. This is how it works. This is how you can beat it because they are unreliable.
Yeah.
That one, I feel has a... It holds itself to a higher standard than the pee test.
Well, okay, how about this? Would it be the same as bringing in a guy who said, hey, I can tell you how to pass a drug test?
There's a question. If it's, you're adding an adulterant to the pee,
mm-hmm.
maybe that would be on par with this polygraph. Other than the fact that you can actually detect the enzymes for something, and that's a lot more accurate than the polygraph in the first place. It's ethics is a
it's so gray area. Interesting, yeah, because it gets very, very granular, right? Because one shift in a circumstance can change the ethics of a situation.
Mm-hmm. And I was thinking like the opposite of granular, that it's this wide spectrum.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. There's a lot of grains in a spectrum. I guess.
There's a lot of data points on this particular graph.
But this one, it sounds like they're playing a side game that has less and less to do with reality, that, you know, like law officials are sort of acquiescing to be offended that this guy is offering information about how to game an unreliable test.
Yeah.
Weird.
It actually kind of reminds me of fingerprints.
What do you mean?
Well, right now, the common thought process is no one has the same fingerprint.
Yeah.
That's never been tested.
What? Yes, it has.
No, it hasn't.
What?
It really hasn't.
Say more.
There have been no scientific studies proving that they are unique.
How can that be? You mean it's just anecdote, like 1 in 3 women are
raped?
Well,
it's pretty good.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, we've seen it be pretty good, but it has never actually been done. For example, especially with regard to the science of fingerprints,
uh-huh.
like where they talk about partial prints, which they'll use to find, you know, that person. That is not, per se, a scientific realm of study. That is purely a law enforcement ad hoc endeavor.
Now, is this based on some reading that you've done?
Yeah.
Do you think you can find a link to some of that reading for the folks? Because I'm sure more than one person is out there going, what?
Now, bear in mind, I don't believe that law enforcement is trying to commit fraud with this. I really don't.
I don't think this
is in good faith.
But this happens a lot where we all sort of take on as truth something because we've all said it enough times that we all think it's true, and it turns out there hasn't actually been the study to back it up.
Yeah, here's this partial fingerprint, and see, this hook means that it's going to be, yeah, that stuff is not very rigorous.
Of course, that might be the corollary of, it turns out mice like cheese. You know, like some of that weird obvious science that happens and everyone's like, no duh.
Well, so, actually, there have been, I'll try to find some links and put it up on GeekSpeak researchers have actually said, like, hey, this is not that level of scrutiny that maybe that would fall under the area that we should be holding people to a standard on the legal sense. Like when they're in court, when you say, here we have this evidence from a partial print, does that meet that standard that should put someone in a jail?
Okay.
That actually, there is a gulf there.
Yeah, particularly with a partial print, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because maybe parts of our prints are identical. It's just that the whole print looks distinct.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe. That's off the top of my head. Science from the top of Bonnie's head here on Geek Speak. All right. Well, let's slip from polygraphs to prison.
from the thing that can put you into prison to actually going into prison.
Yeah, and then maybe finding a way to get yourself productively out of there.
Yeah, a common thing within prisons is job skills and improving them more specifically.
Wait, is it common anymore? Because I heard a lot of those programs are being shut down.
In theory,
yeah.
To lower the rate of recidivism, in other words, having people go right back into prison, you want to give them skills so that they can function in a job market, have money so that they can live a decent life, because one of the reasons why people are in the
is they don't see a productive
market
way.
is because, you know, they're in the drug game because what else are they going to do?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's harder to make a real dollar when you're slogging away for pennies, Walmart workers.
Right.
Yeah.
And so in general, those have been things like how do you learn how to make license plates? But I mean, but I mean, working in the laundry room, working in the kitchen.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a common thing. The short order cook that has had a stint. But what's happening in San Quentin is they were talking about the story here of 18 inmates who have learned how to code. And, in other words, making websites, HTML, CSS, JavaScript.
Now, were they just doing this on their own, or were they part of a program, or what?
There were a couple of Bay Area tech veterans who wanted to help some inmates learn how to code so that they can better themselves. Mm-hmm. Like, branching out in the types of skills that have been traditionally made available. Like, let's be honest, a lot of the skills that have been made available with regard to prisons have been ones that are not exactly a career maker.
High dollar earners.
Right. Or not even just that, but like they're more like how to get a one-off job rather than something that is a general
career building
life skill. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And this is something that is different. And, you know, see how that goes. We're going to, as a web extra, we're going to put up some galleries from Ars Technica of photos taken from inside the prison.
Okay.
Often taken, but seeing what they're working with, seeing
how they're doing. Okay, so we'll get a chance to literally look at what they are doing.
Mm-hmm. And then actually classes given. And
classes given.
Yeah.
See how there's lots of questions, right? Who's going to hire the felon?
Yeah, but that's a general case problem.
Yeah.
But there's also that issue of, will they be able to compete in a market where you have people who've been coding since they were teenagers or younger? And I don't know. There's some people who have an aptitude for it that learn it quicker than others. There are some, but there's also a need.
Mm-hmm. There's a need for people, code?
Sure. There are people who want to be able to make a website and are having trouble with that.
Yeah, that's true.
And, you know, maybe they don't have a long-term relationship with a person. They're just like, hey, can you make me a website and then I'll pay you dollars? And mm-hmm. then they go on their merry way. That's a great way to pick up some extra cash.
Sure, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, okay. Well, I do hope we follow up on that and just kind of see how that program is progressing, because it does seem like something a little bit distinct from what we typically hear about.
Mm-hmm.
Happening, so that's lovely.
And if you want to read more about the story, of course, it's going to be up on our website after the show.
Yeah, fantastic. Let's talk about, should we go back to politics?
It's up to you.
How much time we have left? We've got like a couple of minutes. What can you tell me about the USA Freedom Act?
Oh, as you hit me with the one that I actually don't know as much about. You know what? I'm going to put up the link to the show, link up on the show for people to read about that one, but I'm not going to go into it. I'd rather, because we only have a few minutes left.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Isaac Asimov.
Yeah. Now, that guy wrote a lot of stuff. He was rejected 1 million billion times before he got anything published, by the way.
But he has been a... He was a prolific writer.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
There's no
problem
for him.
I go back and I look
and see.
Yeah. I think that might have been the scientist in him. I'm going like, what? I don't care. I love doing this stuff.
Yeah. All right, I'll try again. So finally, right? It's kind of hard to adapt his stuff into a visual medium because it's so dense.
Yes. Which is
and theoretical.
Really curious about Asimov's writing is that he was not really concerned about being the best, most elegant writer out there.
He's like the Magritte of science fiction writers. Right. He's all about the ideas.
Yeah, and his writing style was very approachable. It was really about the idea, about the universe that he created. But he wasn't writing Ulysses.
Like, yeah,
you know,
he wasn't at this. You know, he wasn't looking for the white whale.
And one of those books, or a series of books that he wrote, were called the Foundation series. One of my favorites in science fiction. It's up there with Dune for me.
Okay. That's big.
And it's really hard to see how one would do it. At the same time, I can see how it would be done. Well, HBO is actually taking up the mantle, which already has a huge...
So we can rely on some good-looking body parts. is that where you're going?
We're going to see some budget put to it.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And so they're going to be making, and it's not just a movie, they're going to be making a series based upon the Foundation series of books, which I think is the best case scenario for this.
Okay.
Because Foundation is not something you can do in 30 minutes.
No.
Not something you can do in 90 minutes.
Well, our correspondent in Canada, Greg Merkley, is just saying that Foundation was a fairly slow-paced series, so he's kind of wondering how they're going to handle that.
The pace probably could be picked up. You probably can use some license. Movies always do this. Like,
yeah,
they're not
you
going
have to
let you plot it through there.
Yeah.
But so it is on a galactic scale, and it is trying to figure out. But at the same time, they can. the montage of time passing has a time-honored 1980s
yeah.
mode for us to build upon. So I'm sure they can do something with that to show that time passing.
They'll figure
or
it.
They may adapt it to say, like, okay, the just time passing is going to be a bit more nebulous.
Uh-huh.
That's not as important as the fact that some time passed.
They're not just going to have the clock on the wall spinning and the calendar pages.
Right, it doesn't
off.
Have to be like... You know, or they can do what they did in the book, which is they cover the same person. They go like, and now they have gray hair. You
oh,
know,
yeah, yeah.
So
now they look paunchy. Well, thanks for listening to Geek Speak here on KUSP. This is the end of the show. Geek Speak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And Geek Speak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. So use our stuff any way you like. Just tell them the geek say hi. This is Public Radio for the Central Coast, 88.9 KUSP Santa Cruz, live online at KUSP.org. To find out more about this or any episode of Geek Speak, please visit geekspeak.org. And our opening theme today was Michael Newman of Pet Star Music.